Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Heather, and I want to remind you about our very special tours to the UK. In 2017, we'll be doing tours focusing on the Evensong experience. The Evensong service comes from Cranmer's Book of Common Prayer from the mid-16th century. It's been dubbed the atheist's favorite service because it requires so little and it gives so much. It's simply divine choral music sung in some of the most historic chapels, abbeys, and cathedrals in England. We'll be spending 10 days visiting places like Cambridge, Oxford, Bath, the Cotswolds, Winchester, and Windsor with walking tours, free time to explore, and then gathering back each afternoon for the Evensong service if you choose to attend. It will be 10 days of beautiful countryside, historic cities and villages, and so, so much music. I invite you to go to englandcast.com/tours for full itinerary and pricing information. Again, Englandcast, E-N-G-L-A-N-D-C-A-S-T, englandcast.com/tours. Thanks so much, and now to the show.
A very special episode of the Renaissance English History Podcast. So I recently had the opportunity to travel to Sydney Sussex College in Cambridge to interview Dr. David Skinner. And what follows is the conversation we had, highlights of which are when he sums up changes in 16th century music in less than 10 words, and the discussion of his research methodology. I am incredibly grateful for his generosity in sharing so much information with us. He mentioned several CDs, YouTube videos, books, and recordings, and I've put links to all of them at http://englandcast.com, www.englandcast.com/Skinner, S-K-I-N-N-E-R. Again, that's englandcast.com/Skinner. Dr. David Skinner is well known as a leading scholar and performer of early music and director of the acclaimed vocal ensemble Alamire. He has also worked with the main early music groups in the UK, including the Cardinals Music as co-founder, the Tallis Scholars, the 16, the Hilliard Ensemble, and the King Singers. David is fellow, tutor, and Osborne Director of Music at Sydney Sussex College, Cambridge University, where he teaches historical and practical topics from the medieval and Renaissance periods. As an engaging presenter, he has worked extensively for BBC Radio, appearing in and writing a variety of shows on Radio 3 and 4. He also acted as music advisor for the Music and Monarchy series on BBC Two with historian David Starkey. He has published widely on music and musicians of early Tudor England and recently published the Tallis Psalter and the Gibbons Hymnal for Novello. He is currently working on a volume of Tallis's early Latin works for publication in 2016. We started the interview with me asking him how his career began.
Yeah, so early on when I came to England for my postgraduate study in Edinburgh and Oxford, I started by really being essentially an academic advisor to the groups that were around at the time, so Tallis scholars, Hill Ensemble 16, and others. And it was a really good experience for me to cut my teeth on editing music and getting it from parchment to CD. You know, so that was something I spent several years doing. It was while I was doing my doctorate in Oxford. And then I set my own group up in 89, the Cardinals Music, with Andrew Carwood. And those were extremely formative years for me, working with Andrew, such a wonderful musician. I was essentially the editor and the researcher, and he conducted the choir. So we started by recording practically every scrap of pre-Reformation English play they could get our hands on. So Nicholas Mudford, Robert Fairfax, John Marbeck, and others. And then we started the Bird Edition. So that went for many years. And then when I came to Cambridge, I just became too busy to work with the Cardinals Music. Andrew became director of music at St. Paul's Cathedral, likewise. So he took over the group, and I set up my own, called Alamire. And this is now is essentially the main catalyst for my research projects. So rather than give my projects to other groups, I now do them myself. I do work with some groups occasionally, mainly now just the King Singers. I offer an early music project to them once every 2 years, and they very kindly record it. So they were just here in Sydney, Sussex, about 2 months ago, performing the latest project, Palestrina, Biblical Passions. But my passion, essentially, is English church music from the mid-15th century up to and beyond Bird, but also dabble in a lot of French and Italian music.
Mm-hmm. So I have to ask, being from California, how did you first get introduced to this world, and how did this become your passion?
Surprisingly, it was the matter of a CD player in a car that was broken, and inside the player was a CD of, no, it wasn't CD, and this is like days of cassette tapes, jeez, a recording by the Hilliard Ensemble. It was just stuck in the car, so that's all I could listen to. And I just really took to the countertenor voice. So when I was singing with the music, I'd sing in the countertenor voice. So I was a countertenor at the age of 16. And I thought, well, the only place I can possibly be is England. So I decided I'm going to be a choral scholar at King's College, Cambridge. No questions asked. It's just going to happen. And then in those days, the Oxford trials were earlier. So I got into Oxford before even attempting to get into Cambridge. So I then got into Christchurch. So that's where I was a choral scholar for many years. And met Andrew Carwood and set up the Cardinals Music and started all my researching.
And one thing I love about your projects is they're so grounded in the history. You're so involved in the history of it, as well as the musical side of things.
It's essential. It really is essential. I mean, when I was setting up these other projects, there always has to be an angle. You know, I mean, it's very popular these days to make a recording of music for Advent or music to drink wine with, or you know, it's they're all sort of thematic rather than actually getting back to basics and the manuscripts that were put together at the time. So much of what we do are based around collections, whole collections that I've researched quite extensively and then edited. So this is our 10th anniversary year, Alan Murray. Mm-hmm. So I've been going for 10 years, and we've got 10 CDs. Mm-hmm. So you can see how the rhythm goes. It takes me a year to conceive a project, edit the music, research it thoroughly, set up the recording venue and the people, all my favorite people, and they're booked well in a year in advance.
And does it change? Does Alamiri, the members change?
It changes. There's a core membership, but we recorded CDs with as few as three people.
Okay.
So the Trinity Carol Roll, which was a few years ago, it's something that looks like a large spring roll, Chinese spring roll, but when you unwrap it, it's actually a parchment that contains the oldest English carols known to exist, and it's in Trinity College. So we recorded the entire manuscript in something called the Trinity Carol Hall. So that was our...
What's the background on that? Like who?
Oh, it was wonderful. Well, you've heard of There Is No Rose.
Mm,
you know,
yeah.
There is no rose. That one. It's in there. And there are a few other famous ones, but there are 13 carols in there, and many of them haven't been heard in modern times. So maybe you want to play it to your audience at Christmas.
Yeah.
But the Trinity Carol Roll, which is beautiful, beautiful Christmas music. And of course, carols aren't just for Christmas, but you know, you get carols for all sorts of things.
The
occasions.
Agincourt Carol.
Yeah. And the Agincourt Carol is in that book too.
Okay.
So it dates from around, we think, 1416, 1417. And the Agincourt Carol being present sort of, you know, gives us a terminus date.
And so for the Spies Choir book as well, talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, up until the Spies Choir book, we essentially have been recording English church music. So we have this wonderful CD of John Taverner, was one of my favourites, that we recorded the complete Canzoni Sacra by Taliesin Burr, 1575, in the order that the books give the music. But in 2009, that was the anniversary year of the coronation of Henry VIII, we recorded a massive book in the British Library, a beautiful manuscript, which has a rose canon. It's very famous. So you've got an open parchment and two roses facing each other. And around the rose, it's some music, and it's a canon. So it's famous for that, but nobody's really recorded the content, and there are a number of motets inside. So we recorded that as part of a British Library project. And that's when we got excited about continental music that reached the shores of England. Okay, and so very few English sources survive on the continent, but we do have quite a few continental sources here in England. And they're
and
all
why was that?
Diplomatic gifts. Okay. So they were gifts to Henry VIII, mostly because he was such a famous lover of music and a patron of music. So the Spies Choir book, essentially, is a book that was gifted to Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon. And it's all about childbearing, and it was done at a time when Catherine was trying to conceive a son. This is a time when young Henry VIII was a very different Henry VIII. He was thin, good-looking, tall, muscular, athletic, very musical. So it represents a period in his life that was highly cultured musically. And we recorded every motet in the book. It was a very expensive and lavish production from the workshop of Petrus Alamiri, where we get our name. So anybody that was anybody in those days, whether you be a cardinal, a bishop, a prince, you want to have Petrus Alamiri design a choir book for you. And there are a number of them that survive today. I mean, they're scattered all over the place, in the Vatican Library, in Germany, here in England.
And he was that you call it Spies Choir Book because he was a spy.
Yeah, I mean it was a good catchphrase because essentially he for musicians it was a great way to travel and see the world, but also a great way to transmit information without being suspected. Because musicians, by nature of who they were and what they did, they would go from court to court. So he wasn't the only spy at the time, but famously he. There are a number of letters that survive between him and Cardinal Wolsey and Henry VIII about his activities. And he was basically spying on the last of the Plantagenets, Richard de la Pole. And in turn, Pole hired him to spy on Henry. So we think he was actually a double agent. Yeah. And so it's a series of letters that in themselves aren't that interesting, apart from the spy aspect. But we do know that this choir book was one of the gifts given to Henry to gain favor. And Henry didn't pay a penny for it. So Alamiri was pretty upset. So when he went home, after being sent home for the last time, there's a letter that says, you know, and of course I gave Henry a number of musical gifts, including a lavish choir book, and I haven't received a penny for any of it.
Oh, So you actually have a reference to the choir book.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
And this is it. I mean, so it was obviously done you know, in the most lavish of ways with all the best inks, the best scribes, because Alighieri would have had a basically a workshop of people. So okay. it's from the workshop of Petrus Alighieri. We don't know if his actual hand is in the book, mm-hmm. but certainly it is from his workshop.
Yeah. And that's interesting that Henry didn't pay anything for it because he was such a patron of the arts, right?
Yeah.
So, but I guess he wanted
to get wind that Petrus Alighieri was talking to LePaul. So Wolsey just cut him off. So basically was it. So I'm not surprised he wasn't paid.
Right.
It's a good thing he just wasn't paid, not bought alive.
Yeah. For sure. He lucked out there. Interesting. And so we kind of touched on this, but I'm really interested in like kind of the methodology that you use when you research these projects and just kind of how you approach, like what your approach is with them and how you pick a project and then how you research it.
My projects are always, they're conceived in one of two ways. Somebody comes up to me and says, we'd like to do this project. Mm-hmm. Would Alighieri be interested in doing it?
Mm-hmm.
So like the 2009 Henry VIII project was a direct plea from the British Library. We'd like to record this manuscript. We'd like you guys to do it. So that was great. Mm-hmm. But for everything else, it's centered on my own primary research interests. So Taverner was my first love, and I edited a lot of his music. So often you get recordings of his masses, and rarely do you get a recording just of his antiphons and ritual music. So that's what I always wanted to do. So that was one. Another one was the Talus and Bird project. Never had these very famous motets in 1575 being recorded in the order that they were intended, or indeed that Bird and Talus put them in.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot in terms of vocal pitch and scoring, and it's all laid out in the liner notes. So it sort of feeds my imagination about how these projects work. Spy's Choir Book was just something that I realized existed, and we all know about it. It's, if you go into the British Library and they have a musical exhibition, it's always wheeled out as the great thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's got a great opening page. You can just see it right there in the corner of my office. But it's a beautiful manuscript. But surprisingly,
that's the cover of the disc,
of
right?
The disc,
so I'll just have an image of that.
Yeah, well, the whole thing right here. Okay.
Oh wow!
They're quite extraordinary thing.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I was beginning to ask myself, so what else is in the book? Have people recorded it? And I researched it. Nobody had. So, you know, there are just these wonderful discoveries in the book. So we just decided to record every single note. And I'm very fortunate having a project patron in Patricia Brown, a great supporter of the arts. So whenever I have anything highly academic that needs to be done,
mm-hmm.
and there's no financial backing for it, she provides the financial backing. So straight after this, another manuscript, now in the Royal College of Music, manuscript 1070, sounds very boring.
Uh-huh.
And it's actually the size of an A4 book. I mean, it's not that big, like a notepad.
Uh-huh.
But you open it up, and it's begins as a rather formal layout of some music. And then it goes rather informal in the middle, different hands. And then you have a little inscription, Mistress Anne Boleyn, now thus, which was the motto of her father. So we think that the book actually was started when she was a girl in France, and she would have been exposed to the music of Josquin, LaRue. She probably met these people. And
she was quite cultured.
Very cultured. She learned everything that she needed to know in France, so that her father was a mover and shaker, wanted her to do well at court,
mm-hmm.
and actually marry into Ireland, and of course, rather, she married into Henry VIII, mm-hmm. Either to her credit or not, but we do have this book, and not many people know it exists.
Mm.
I mean, academics know it exists.
Yeah.
And you know, I was talking to my colleagues here. They said, "So you're attempting 1070? Yeah, mm-hmm. that's great. It's a big book. There are 46 compositions in it, and some of them are incomplete. Some of them overlap with the Spy's Choir book, but most of it is anonymous and gorgeous. So, and it's different in Spy in that it gives us more." More layers of sound. So rather than four-part French notettes, we've got some five-part, we've got some six-part, we've got some French chansons, so we've incorporated a lute and some harp and solo singing. So it's a very nice, balanced program. And I just loved so much of the music that I couldn't squeeze it all into a single CD, so we have a double CD again.
Right.
It's not the entire book, because you can't do it, because there's some stuff that's missing. But essentially, it's an hour and a half of my favorite pieces from this collection, which again have not been edited or heard in modern times.
That's amazing. So I'm really interested in what music, the musical experience was like for people, both at court and then also for the common people who were living during this time period. So what can you tell? So we could start with the court part, the sort of high part. So going through the Tudor monarchs, what can you tell me about what their musical experiences were and how they felt about music?
Ooh, it's a big question. I think the easiest way to think about it is that essentially, and if we maybe skip to a particular period, so say the 16th century, and it could apply to the 15th century and before too, but I mean, high art music, especially church music, in England at least, didn't really get going in a major way until the end of the 14th century. Mm-hmm. It was all courtly, or the church music that you did have were ceremonial. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the idea that the plain chant that used to adorn the liturgy was transferred into something more grand, polyphony, is very much a 15th century idea.
Mm-hmm,
okay,
mm-hmm.
So high art music and folk music are just like what we have today,
sure.
Classical music and rock and roll. Okay, but if you think about the high art music, it's all centered either around the church or around the courtly dance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so instrumental music, we think, was largely improvised until the middle of the 16th century, when it began to be written down for instruments rather than, at least in England, rather than the idea of instruments playing vocal parts. So we knew that always happened in the 15th
mm-hmm.
century. You can get a group of people and get a broken consort and play through vocal music.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of having instrumental music written for instruments with the particular quirks of, say, a viol, we have repeated notes, shimmering,
mm-hmm.
is very much an idea of the mid-16th century.
Mm-hmm.
And out of the idea of the in nomine settings, an improvisation on the chant in nomine from the Gloria Tibi Trinitas.
Mm-hmm.
Tavern set. But high art music would have been experienced really by a very small proportion of the populace, and we reckon the top 2%.
Okay.
Unless you happen to be lucky enough to live near a collegiate church. Now, England had something like 200 professional liturgical choirs dotted around the country.
And these come from the colleges.
And we're not talking about Oxford and Cambridge, although they are colleges, but before the Reformation, there were a number of colleges of royal foundation, noble foundation, mm-hmm. or even just wealthy merchants that would set up these institutions and set up a group of priests, singing men and boys, to sing and pray for the souls of the founder. Okay. So these were set up quite typically with polyphonic choirs. And as I said, there were about 200 of them around the time that Henry VIII began to tinker
mm-hmm.
with the colleges and the monasteries. And the average size, surprisingly, is quite small. So when you think of a concert choir today in America, maybe it's performing some Fairfax or even Byrd or something,
mm-hmm.
something 16th century, something quite popular today. It could be a concert choir of 40,
right.
or more. The Tudor choir, surprisingly, is small,
mm-hmm.
and it made up in many places like four men
mm-hmm.
and seven boys. So if you've got a five-part piece of polyphony, you would imagine that the men's parts would have been sung by soloists, and the boys maybe four on the soprano and three on the alto.
Mm-hmm.
So chamber choir, very mm-hmm. much a chamber choir.
Mm-hmm.
The bigger choirs that came out were really from the time of Cardinal Wolsey, and when he set up Cardinal College in our Christchurch, it was an enormous choir, 16 choristers and 12 men.
Wow.
That's huge. But that is still, I mean, by most standards, a chamber choir.
Sure. Now, did these choirs have to sing every service? Because weren't there like a number of services after Henry V and Agincourt? Didn't he add to the services? And weren't they singing like six or seven times a day or something like that?
Well, the monastic and collegiate liturgical cycle had been pretty much in place even long before then. So you basically have a cycle of the masses and a cycle of the offices running side by side, day in, day out. So if you take a typical day in any major collegiate institution, and it depends on what type of institution they are, but imagine the community waking up in the middle of the night for matins.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the larger morning services. And then when the sun rises, Lords. So two big services there. And then you have prime, tet, sext, and non. These are smaller offices that don't really have polyphony, such as plain chant.
Okay.
But you would hear polyphony in the great and morning offices. And then you'd have your afternoon off for recreation, eating, gardening, writing music. And then you'd have vespers at dusk, and that's where your Magnificat comes from. And then finally compline before bed. Within all of that, you have the structure of the commemorations or masses. So you have a mass of the day, you have a mass for the morrow, commemorating the next day, a lady mass. On top of that, you have masses that were paid for by the community or those that have left money for them to sing and pray for their souls. So you then have masses darting around all over the place. So if you take a very large building like Westminster Abbey, if you've ever walked into one of these English cathedrals, you'll notice that there are side altars. So all the main body of the masses and the offices would take place in the choir, in the center of the church, but you'd have masses being said or sung all around the edges. I mean, it'd be a very noisy place.
Yeah.
So in a typical day, you think about it, you've got matins, lauds, primes, tets, sexts, non, vespers, compline, that's eight services, plus at least three principal masses, 9, 10, 11, plus commemorations. So that's day in, day out. There are no free days.
That's a lot of singing.
That's a lot of singing. But you've got to remember that the polyphony would have been reserved for the greater offices and also for greater feasts.
Okay.
So they wouldn't have been singing this stuff. They couldn't. I mean, they'd lose their voices.
Right.
So, I mean, just hurrying away with playing
chapel. I didn't know whether maybe there were, like, they took in shifts or something, you know? So
Chapel Royal did. You had service days in Chapel Royal because it was such a large institution.
Yeah.
So you have decane eye service and cantoris, so they swap back and forth, we think. But no, certainly, you know, these institutions, and they were set up with all the right intentions, but, I mean, reading through the success or otherwise of how these institutions actually worked, and that was when Cromwell was constructing the dissolution of the monastery for Henry VIII, he prepared what's called the Black Book. And it's all the things that these institutions were getting up to that they shouldn't get up to. I've read visitation records of institutions. And visitation essentially is the bishop coming to an institution, taking everybody aside and saying, is everything running according to statute? And it's one-on-one, on pain of excommunication. You've got to tell me the truth. So every possible vice that you can think of that a human might get up to
comes
in 21st
out.
Century, England happened back then.
Right.
So, I mean, there was fornication. I mean, so many of the... there's this one... who was it? It was the master of the Abbey of Dorchester in Oxfordshire, and he managed to impregnate at least 13 women. And that was found out in the visitation.
Wow.
But
he was busy.
But he was able to keep his job because all you have to do is to bring two fellows with you to actually say, well, actually, I'm innocent, and I've got two witnesses.
Right.
He's the master. He's got these two fellows here, and they say, yeah, he's innocent.
Yeah.
Essentially, he's guilty. Yeah. But I mean, there's some really blue reading in these visitation records.
Yeah. Interesting. No wonder Cromwell wanted to...
Yeah. Well, he had a point. I mean, he had a point. I mean, well, very famously, it was the idea that he's collecting all the relics and showing just how powerless they were.
Right.
And he collected so many bits of the cross of Jesus Christ. He said, there's so much wood here. You know, we have a forest of crosses. So somebody's lying.
Right.
But there's a vial which contained apparently the breast milk of the Virgin Mary. And he commented, well, it's not fact that we actually have it, but how did we get it from her in the first place?
Right.
You know, all these questions that were never really asked.
Right.
So, you know, the Reformation was brewing and it had to happen.
Yeah. Interesting. So I kind of got you a bit sidetracked there, but this is all really interesting. So we know that Henry VIII was a huge patron and loved music. Mm. What about the other tutors? Elizabeth would have as well, but what about Edward and Mary? What in there in the middle?
They were too busy with Reformation. I mean, Edward was a boy king, of course. What he did do was actually implement a very Protestant church. So the Reformation under Henry was political.
Right.
It was all political. So essentially, the church services didn't change. Nothing changed liturgically, apart from the introduction of an English litany, which is a very small part of it.
Mm-hmm.
When Edward came to the throne, he and his council turned the Reformation into one that wasn't political but doctrinal. So it's all about changing everything. So,
because couldn't you, even at the end of Henry VIII's reign, you would still be imprisoned for heresy if you denied the true presence, right?
Well, Henry was swinging back and forth. He didn't know which way his head was on, really.
Right.
And it all depended on which queen he was with.
Right.
So it was interesting that with his last queen, Catherine Parr, this is our next project after Anne Boleyn. It's very exciting stuff about Talis that's just come to light. But, Catherine Parr was conservative. And then Catherine Parr was a reformist, and Henry VIII at the time was a conservative, but he was being talked back and forth, and it depends on which day of the week you're talking to the king as to which way he was leaning, but essentially, in terms of music, nothing would have changed because the liturgy didn't change. There was nothing to be introduced like the Book of Common Prayer, which was introduced in 1549. So when that hit the shelves, you've got a situation where before the death of Henry, you would need a mountain of liturgical books to perform the daily services and masses. And that's all replaced by a single slimline book in English.
Mm-hmm.
And the musicians weren't told how to compose this music. They were just given the new prayer book. So people like Talis would look at the prayer book and you'd say, and the clerks will sing this in English, so Magnificat. So an entire new repertoire had to be created. And the interesting thing is that Talis is probably the first man to master the form, and certainly the first one to actually, I think, put pen to paper and make it work. So the very earliest compositions we know date from 1549, 1550, If He Loved Me, for example. So you get these amazingly long votive antiphons by Talis written probably as late as 1547, 1548 even, after the death of Henry, because the prayer book hadn't been introduced. And all following that old, very grand Eton choir book form of these arcing lines and 15-minute votive antiphons in Latin, very melismatic. And then in the next year, you've got a four-part piece in English, very simple, 2 minutes long.
Oh, wow.
And it's biblical.
Right.
So music becomes, the function of music fundamentally changes. It's less for spirituality and more for again, delivering a very clear message, essentially a sermon in music.
And wasn't there a rule that you couldn't have more than two syllables to a note or something, and that's where
as Cranmer, he was saying, in his opinion, for every note there should be a syllable. And I think he was talking about essentially the processional, so that it could be heard, so melisma is not there. But really, nothing other than that was said about how composers should compose.
Okay.
So when you look at music from Edward's reign, it's essentially a very different style completely.
And then it, of course, has to go back under Mary.
And then under Mary, Catholicism returns. However, composers are rejoicing in this, and they've learned something quite fundamental about writing in their own language for 6 years. So Latin church music under Mary becomes far more texty. You can really understand the text. So finally, English composers are approaching their own renaissance in terms of text setting. You compare a votive antiphon by Taverner from the 1530s by something by Talis in the 1550s, and again, night and day. Essentially because for 6 years, Talis experimented in writing in his own language, where the remit was to make the text as clear as possible. So that is fed into the Latin church music under Mary.
And then with Elizabeth, swing back.
It goes both ways. Because, Elizabeth, after the turmoil of her half-brother and half-sister, she sat on the fence early in her reign. So she reintroduced the Book of Common Prayer, but priests were allowed to wear their coats, and all these beautiful things in the churches were allowed to be shown. And composers were allowed to write in any language they wished.
But then how did that change throughout her reign? Because didn't she come down quite harshly against the...
That's only when her crown was threatened, And, Mary Queen of Scots and the idea of replacing her with a Catholic. So, and it drove Catholics underground. And that's what famously is going on with Byrd, except Byrd was an exception. And he had a license to be a Catholic. He actually had a dispensation to be a Catholic.
Wow.
So he was allowed to worship privately as long as he didn't, do anything to danger the crown or the queen. And he didn't. I mean, he was a Catholic, but he was also a good Englishman.
Sure. That was a tough line for Catholics to have to walk on to, because it's the Pope's excommunicating your monarch at the same time. But now, I'm interested in the Catholic underground music as well. I've heard that the bird masses, the 3 and 4 and 5 part, were written for Catholics to be able to sing in their home when they were doing like a secret mass. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, we don't know when they were written. They were probably written in the 1580s. They were published really anonymously in the middle of the 1590s. And we have an estimated publication date. I think the 4 part came first, and then it was the 5 and the 3, or it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. But they were published within a couple of years of each other. And what's interesting, you've got a 3-part, 4-part, 5-part, as you say, which means that Byrd is setting up something that hadn't been composed since the 1550s, a Latin mass. Mm. And he was very keen that it would cater for any occasion. So the 5-part mass would be a full robed choir. He's envisaging boys and men, all the parts represented. The 4-part can be done by just men, mm-hmm. or you can transpose it up and do it with higher voices. The 3-part, similarly. Mm-hmm. It sort of ties in with his work on the Gradivalia, and the Gradivalia are two massive books that are basically, it's the propers of the Catholic Church year. Mm-hmm. So you get the Temporale and the Sanctorale, so the times of the year, mm-hmm. and then masses towards some of the saints, for some of the saints. So he produced basically an entire repertoire for English Catholics, I think, in the knowledge, his knowledge, that England would one day return Catholicism. So he set up a legacy for the Catholic mm-hmm. people in these wonderful musical gifts. But he published them, quite openly and legally. And I mean, the Gradivalia, surprisingly, was published the year of the Gunpowder Plot. So, when the Catholics tried to blow up king and country, Byrd presents the Gradivalia, which mm-hmm. could only be for Catholic use. Mm-hmm. But the masses are, it's a little bit more dangerous. So you find that there are no title pages. But on every single page is WB. So there's no question as to who wrote it. But again, he had a license to practice as a Catholic.
But would that have extended into James then?
We don't really know what happened. The reason we know about the dispensation is because when James came to the throne, Byrd wrote to him and said, I have enjoyed certain rights and privileges as a recusant Catholic under Elizabeth, and I hope that these will continue under your gracious reign. There's no reply that survives, but obviously he was given the dispensation because he continues to produce this music well into 1610. So,
interesting.
But, you're asking about the performances of the Mass in the households, and it's interesting because nowadays we hear them in churches, and so quite very much in a religious setting. In Byrd's day, it would have been in a patron's house, and whoever was there that could perform it would perform, even if it's a female. So we know, for example, that on occasion, some of Byrd's patrons probably would have picked up a book and sung a boy's part. If there weren't enough singers, and there was a viol in the corner, you'd pick up a viol and play the part with that. So very, very loose performance practice issues here. How do you perform an authentic version of the Byrd Masses?
Yeah.
The best thing to do is to get around a table in a private household with part books and sing one to a part,
mm-hmm.
Which we did in Ingatestone Hall not so long ago.
There's a YouTube video of that.
That was so cool because that had never been done before.
Yeah.
We happened to be there for a conference, and I said, look, let's just do this. And I got some facsimiles. We sang through the 4-part Kyrie in a dry room, in a space that Byrd would have known, and where he would have produced this music. It was wonderful.
Very cool. So you mentioned the women potentially singing, and I wanted to ask you what role women would have had in music, and probably in the kind of liturgical music, not a lot. But
nothing whatsoever.
Right.
Unless it was private.
Yeah.
In a private household. We don't really know, but women had no no role whatsoever in liturgical music, in polyphony.
Mm-hmm.
Their place was very much domestic. And many women learnt how to play instruments. We know Queen Elizabeth played practically everything. Anne Boleyn was great on the lute and other things. So it was very much a domestic pastime.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of religious music, they probably would have known it, because we do have a number of sources that have been created out of vocal sources. So you get these trios and duos that you find in Talis, Taverner, Fairfax, large-scale Vodovantophons that had been detached from the original form and put into instrumental books. Mm-hmm. So they no longer have their texts, but you just have the three-part music, and we know that they would have been either sung, most likely played on the lute or viols or a combination of such, and women would have very much had a part in that.
Interesting. And so one question back to Elizabeth, with that time, of course, is known as the Golden Age of... well, English church music and choral music. What is it about that time that makes it so special?
I suppose it's the two things. I think it's the idea that the Reformation happened, and you know, for my students here in Cambridge, I used to do a Reformation paper, and one of the questions is, was the Reformation a good thing for music? Because essentially, we're talking about a time of destruction and you know, limitation on what composers could do. However, composers were forced into thinking about other styles than the early florid style. So in many ways, it opened their eyes to other ways of composition. By the time you get to the other end of it, and you're into the Elizabethan settlement, when things are beginning to settle down, that composers now have everything they need on their work desk to create practically anything. So you get voices and instruments performing together in church for the first time. You know, the idea of the verse service and the verse anthem. Viols become a very, very important part of the compositional process in terms of the consort song and the consort anthem. So it's just essentially there's more to be done, and it's the age of Shakespeare. It's just very enlightened. So there's more opportunity for things to happen, I think, than ever before.
Interesting. The 16th century was a huge time of change for music. If you could just sum up the changes in a couple of words, is that possible?
Okay. Yeah, I think I can do that. Okay, so essentially we're talking about life before the prayer book and life after the prayer book. So like a very sharp knife cutting right into the middle of the 16th century, 1549, if you envisage a large slab of cheese that represents the 16th century, 1549 is right in the middle, isn't it? Give or take a few millimeters. You cut that out. That first chunk is all Catholic, all traditional music making, a form that had been sort of stylized and worked out over many centuries, and it was cut short by the Reformation. Mm-hmm. Everything after is new. And new ideas, incorporating some old techniques, but all new ideas. Mm-hmm. So essentially, we're talking about the introduction of the English Rite, and that changes everything.
Interesting. That's a great summation. Okay. That's very impressive.
Like the cheese bit.
that's very, very cool. And so then we talked a lot about the religious side of things and the high sort of high art. What kind of was the equivalent of pop music? And of course, they wouldn't have had any way to disseminate. There weren't radio stations and Sirius XM and whatever. Yeah. But I know we hear the story about Pastime with Good Company that Henry VIII wrote, and it suddenly becomes this massive pop hit. Yeah. But what did normal people?
Well, that's music for the court, and that's not even for normal people. Right. I mean, that's still for the court.
Right. Okay.
So the Henry VIII songbook contains, I think, at least 33 compositions by the king, as well as secular melodies by court composers and members of the Chapel Royal. Again, this is high art music, because not many people can read this stuff. Mm-hmm. You need professionals, and it would have been professional singing men and boys that performed this. In terms of the everyday person, I think we're looking at the idea of incidental music for plays. Mm-hmm. And that's where we really have a lack of music. Mm-hmm. We have a few broadsheets with some tunes that we know that would have been passed out as sold during a performance. And we're talking about something that might have happened, you know, even in Shakespeare's Globe. You know, there would have been music. Some of it would have been notated. A lot of it would have been improvised. Mm-hmm. So there are very famous melodies like the Browning tune or other tunes you know, Greensleeves was actually an Italian tune, we believe. It has nothing to do with Henry VIII. But these famous tunes would be improvised, and like a jazz musician would do today. You take a popular tune and you play it. And that's, I think, what a lot of the everyday person would have known.
That would have been
unless they lived right down the road from Arundel Castle And they went into the parish church and they heard the collegiate choir singing Mass. I mean, and that would have been all over the country. So if you're fortunate enough in living close to a collegiate church, there was always a parish side. Mm-hmm. So the parish could come in and hear this music. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't entirely exclusive. Mm-hmm. The Chapel Royal would have been. But these college establishments would have produced music of the highest quality as well.
Mm. And that would have been, of course, people by law would have had to have attended their masses and everything, right? Yeah, I mean, they would have had to.
Well, attendance. I mean, it would have been expected. I mean, yeah. Although you wouldn't take communion. I'm not an expert on this, but I do think that the idea of taking the weekly communion didn't yet exist. It was the idea that you would go once or twice a year to receive those. And most of the time, you have nothing to do. You're sitting. You've got to imagine a church again, like that big piece of cheese being cut right in half. You've got the bit for the priests and the singing men,
mm-hmm.
And it's all adorned with marble and incense and beautiful tapestries. And on the parish side, you don't have pews. You have essentially straw on the floor because when you come in, you kneel with your prayer book and you witness what's happening through there. You know, and what's interesting, you can still go into some of these churches in Norfolk. That still have their rood loft and their screens, and you can look into the parish. You can look from the parish side of the church into the collegiate side of the church, and there are little eye holes that are drilled through, so you can see what's going on.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. Eamon Duffy, his book Stripping of the Altars, is a must read for anybody that's interested in this sort of thing.
Okay, excellent. I will look that up as well. Okay, so I've gone on here for quite some time. Is there anything that you want to add in about your current projects? Oh, and also I want to ask you, for people, average Americans living in Lincoln, Nebraska, or you know somewhere like that, who might not have experience of this music, who haven't been in a car with a tape stuck in it like you were, what's valuable about this music for them to be able to experience? Why should they and how can they?
Because you've got to be lucky and pick up the right CD from the right group, because you could pick up a CD that would probably put you off early music forever if it's done in a bad way. Mm-hmm. So you want to pick a really good group.
Like Alan Mirre.
Alan Mirre, Talis Scholars, 16, you know, any of the established groups. Mm-hmm. And it's also then picking the right genre. And whatever you want. I mean, I would recommend picking up our Tabula record, and you might want to play a little bit of this on your podcast, but it essentially is music that is so honest and so spiritual. And I was asked the same question. We were on tour in Tennessee, and it was a student radio program. They said, so what do you think this music is going to do for us? I mean, how do you get your average teenager in America who listens to rock music or whatever, interested in this stuff? And I said, look, this Tavern record has just come out. Listen to this. And it's just ethereal, utterly gorgeous. It mesmerizes you, puts you into another world.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, look, if you wanted to have a relaxed evening with the person that you love, try this. Put this record on, light some candles, pour some fine wine. This will do the business more than any pop song.
Right.
It really will. It'll transport you into another world.
Mm.
And try it, you know. And we sold a lot of CDs that day, so it was great. It does work, but you know, it has to be the right music.
Yes.
And the thing is, there's an honesty and a beauty of 16th century music that must be learnt. I mean, you've got to expose yourself to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I haven't listened to pop music since I was 14. And now, when I hear it, it all sounds the same to me.
Right.
And I know that when people hear my music,
they
say it sounds all the same. You know, but there's a nuance that you just have to get used to, and it's worth the effort.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny because when my husband plays rock music on his guitar, and I play him this kind of music, and he just says, oh, it all sounds the same. But then I was showing him your YouTube videos,
yeah.
and he said, oh, it makes such a difference for me to be able to see how it's done
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
He said, like, this is mesmerizing. I could listen to this all day now that I know.
Yeah.
I had no idea before. Are there 50 people or 100 people
yeah, yeah.
or 3 people?
Yeah.
And so maybe being able to experience it, even if you can't do it live, being able to go and look
yeah.
at videos and see how.
That's always what people comment when they hear Alan Dearian live. They can't believe just how few people there are. You know,
it's like the King Singers,
yeah,
too.
Got, yeah.
6 people.
You've got 10 people on the stage for something like a big project like Taverner or Talis and Bird. And the sound will just, it's so powerful
mm-hmm.
and so in tune and at times so loud,
mm-hmm.
But in a pleasant way. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's just really, really exciting. It's just energy, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what we strive for with Alan Dearian. I spend so much time talking about how to sing on the vowel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the idea of opening up the vowel in a very sweet space
mm-hmm.
in that rings. So
mm-hmm.
when you hear our music, it's just so in tune
mm-hmm.
and powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, if you can get 2 people singing together the same line in a similar way, but having different vocal timbres,
mm-hmm.
You can amplify the sound 3-fold.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I always go for like all of the sections. Having a voice that has blade or edge to the sound
mm-hmm.
and a voice that has body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and you put the two together, it's like having 2 ranks of pipes that are just meant to be together.
Yeah.
That just makes it, you know, huge. So that opening 4-part piece on the Anne Boleyn YouTube video, there's just 4 parts for men. It sounds enormous,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it's but nothing like when it's live. I mean, you can never create that.
Right. Excellent. And is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about projects you're working on now that you want to...
Well, at the moment, so Spy is doing very well. So watch this space. We're just, you know, we're hoping to win some awards. We'll see.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's too early to tell.
Mm-hmm.
But Anne Boleyn has just been published. So, I mean, today it's gone to the manufacturer, so it's done. And we'll have a copy of that in August. The official release date worldwide is the 1st of October, but you can get the music on Amazon,
mm-hmm.
I think, as early as the end of August,
okay.
2015. So it'll be there. We've got concerts at the Globe Theatre in London and then again in Cadogan Hall, and we're desperate to come to the United States of America
okay.
with this program. So
mm-hmm.
anybody out there that wants us to come and perform, we'll be there in a heartbeat. Just need to put it together. But following that is, because this is sort of the end of the trilogy of projects that we're doing. So the Spy's Choir book is about Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon, his first queen.
Mm-hmm.
Then Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, so the Anne Boleyn project.
Mm-hmm.
This next project is about his last wife, Catherine
mm-hmm.
Parr. And it's tied in with something I can't really advertise at the moment, but just to say that in terms of what we know about Thomas Tallis, it's very little.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because we know a lot about Bird because he always got into trouble. So he's always in the law courts. So there's lots of archival evidence about him. Tallis kept his nose clean, and he was just a very, very fine musician and very quiet. But some new evidence has come forward that really sheds brand new light on Tallis's music and the chronology of his music. And we actually have a new piece of music that hasn't been heard, I can even give you the year, hasn't been heard since 1544.
Mm-hmm.
And it puts the rest of his music completely in line. So
mm-hmm.
the chronology has always been a problem with Tallis. You know, how do you date certain pieces? This changes everything. So it's going to be introduced in Cambridge in a conference in November, and then
mm-hmm.
Alan Miri are going to record early next year, and then it'll all be published in the Oxford University Press journal, Early Music, in
mm-hmm.
May of 2016.
Excellent.
So 2016 is the year of Anne Boleyn and Thomas Tallis.
Yes. Oh, perfect. Awesome. Very cool. So watch this space for that. Anything else you want to add that I haven't asked? Is there anything really important that I missed that I should have asked you?
Not really. I mean, only that. I mean, Alan Miri is just one side of what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my main job is teaching here at Cambridge, but
mm-hmm.
I've got my own college choir,
mm-hmm.
The choir of Sydney Sussex College Chapel, and we were just on tour in America for 3 weeks,
okay.
and we had such a great time. But they're really one of the top ensembles
mm-hmm.
in Cambridge. They've become really among the top 3 in the last couple of years. Okay. So stunning musicians and it's sort of the two feed each other. So the idea of working with student musicians and professional musicians, mm-hmm. I learn so much mm-hmm. every time I work with them. Mm-hmm. So they do feed into each other, and I think it really helps my own interpretation and also choir training. You know, mm-hmm.
Do they perform the services?
Yeah, we exist here essentially to perform the services, mm-hmm. but we go on 3 tours a year. So this year we went to Austria, Rome, and America, mm-hmm. and we've been to Dubai and all over the world, actually. And so we travel quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But it's mm-hmm. essentially a young version of Alamire, because they're taught by the same choir master. Sure. It's just smaller voices, but it's the same sort of idea of energy and tuning.
And are there men and women?
Yep.
So,
yeah. Okay. Exactly like Alamire, just bigger, 24 singers.
Okay, fantastic. So if anybody's listening in the UK, come to Cambridge. And attend an Evensong.
Yeah.
Come to Sydney Sussex.
Come
attend.
Get a choral scholarship. Please.
Or at least come for the day and listen to some great music. Go to Evensong service.
Great.
Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. So thank you so
thank you.
Much. And so I guess I'm going to hit stop here. But I'm going to fade out with some wonderful music. And then we'll put links up to all of the YouTube videos as well that we talked
great.
About. So. Again, a huge thank you to Dr. David Skinner for so generously sharing his time and his knowledge. Please go to http://www.englandcast.com/Skinner, S as in Sam, K-I-N as in November, N as in November, E-R. So englandcast.com/Skinner. For links to all of the books, recordings, and videos that he mentions. And please buy his CDs. They're amazing. Thank you so much for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.